You're listening to a jazz profile of trumpeter and bassist Bill Falwell. This is coming to you on WKCR FM in New York.
So you're saying you had been thinking about the bass as something that you were interested in and
pursuing,
would follow up.
Definitely pursuing, so I'd have something to fall back. I wanted to be a musician. How many trumpet players you can have? How many bass players? Oh, everybody's. The bass players are in demand.
There you go.
They are in demand.
So a little bit of pragmatic thinking on your
yeah.
side.
Well, yeah. I the purpose of being a musician was to earn a living, you know, because that was where I came from. That's what my parents expect me to do, is earn a living,
not right.
just kind of fritter away the rest of my life doing what I wanted. I'm just supposed to make a living. So bass seemed like a good thing to do,
yeah.
and I enjoyed doing it. And yeah. So I joined the Army. No, they joined me. And
and you're off to Fort Knox.
I'm off to Fort Knox. I said, whoa, this is terrible. And they put me on a train. And I remember I got the note from Flo to write something about Perry. I said, well, sure, I'll write something. I sat down and started to type up something. And it had nothing to do with Perry at all, so I never did get to Perry. But it was I was on the train, you know, and it's kind of naive. I'd been through New York and been through having checks ripped off by other jazz musicians and, you know, ripped out of the back and forged. And I had my share of problems, and I said, oh, look at this little cat, this little door here in the train. That's nice. I'll just put my wallet and my shoes up there and go to bed and sleep. Woke up in the morning, and my shoes were there, shined, and there was no wallet there. Oh, jeez, what did I do? So I didn't know there was a little door outside.
Right.
It's kind of naive, I guess. But the guy gave me back my wallet. He's just,
Nice guy.
He's just jerking my chain a little, and I get used to that. So got the Army, did the Army thing. They said, where do you want to go? I want to be a musician. That's all I know how to do. I can only do music. And so they said, okay, you're going to the Navy School of Music, I'm in the Army. Well, that's where they train. They have a special little setup. It's in Washington, D.C., in Anacostia, which is across the river, and mm-hmm. we send you down there, and you'll get your training. Well, there is where I met Perry and Tom.
Perry Robinson and Tom Price were talking
it.
About.
And there's some other guys there, and I may remember them in the course of this conversation.
What were the musical act? I mean, obviously those people come to mind because you scoped out a unique way of making music with them and formed sort of a small group within a group from this Navy band. What were the other, or were there other experiences from that music education, courtesy of Uncle Sam this time in Washington area? Did you remember playing in the band as, well, this is where I, you know, changed my outlook on so-and-so, or this was where I sharpened up my skills doing thus-and-so? More importantly, were you playing trumpet or were you playing bass when you walked into the Army band?
I was signed on as a trumpet player, but I, you know, they have bass there, and you play jazz? Oh, yeah, I play jazz, too. Oh, yeah, okay, let's get together and play jazz. So we jammed and we hung out and we walked around and did all the stuff that you do in the when you're not doing the stuff they want you to do. You know? So, and we had a little group, nice little group. Perry, Tom, myself, and a trumpet player do you know who I'm talking
about? Jim Knapp, you mean?
Yep, Jim Knapp.
Yeah, I've heard reports that he's the one that we don't know about, I guess, because he didn't hang with, there wasn't much room for a quartet within the Uni Trio, but...
Well, no, it wasn't. It was just, the stroke of the pen. He didn't get sent to Panama we got sent to Panama.
So do you remember that the Uni Trio, this band of Tom Price on drums and Perry Robinson playing clarinet, did that group fall together in Washington and then shipped out together, or you decided to...
I think happened really in Panama.
In Panama.
Because we were there, and it was like throwing seeds into the garden, you know. It's fertile.
Yeah,
fertile there, and there's plenty of time and space to.
I got to say that hearing Perry talk about it and hearing Bill Falwell talk about it here, Maybe the Army would have a better time if they got you guys to do their advertisements and say, well, this is what it was like, you know, palm trees, commanding officer who said, do whatever you want. We had great contact with the local musicians, the local artists and so on. It was warm all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we played all night and we came out of it with a great professional experience. And that doesn't sound like anybody else's military experience.
Well, maybe not. And I don't think it'd be great on the advertising posters either.
Maybe not either.
Maybe not. But could we pursue that? No. but anyway, that's exactly what it was. It was we fell into it as a perfect situation.
Right.
And the band was there was no like I think in the as going back I tried to get into the Airmen a note. Bob Satola got me a audition with them, and I right. didn't make that because that's a real big band, you know.
Yeah.
I wasn't a big band player. I was, you know, I was a jazz player.
Right.
I like Miles Davis. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, we were the music for that area of the country. We were the marching band. We were the dance band. We were everything.
In Panama.
Yeah. In Panama.
When you were stationed.
Fuerte Amador.
Right.
So that was our job, and we had a little barracks, whatever, and on the second floor, and the wind wafting off the canal, and it was great. It was just great.
Did it come in handy at that time for all the presumably the multifarious activities that you had, you know, going here, learning local music, playing, you know, U.S. brass band music or whatever, that you were versatile enough to play trumpet on the one hand and play bass on the other?
Oh, absolutely. I did,
so you would you know, switch off as necessary?
Absolutely. Just did what I wanted and or what was needed.
Right.
But we did whatever was needed. But the fun part was with Perry. And you've listened to Perry, so you know what it's like to
hang with him.
To hang with Perry.
Yeah.
And we just would play, and then we'd talk, and we'd do, and then it was just, you know, it was good. It was really good. And nobody bugged us. Nobody. We just did what we did. We were there on time. We kept our noses clean, whatever. And it was great.
Yeah.
And Perry has probably talked about the trips. We took about three or four trips as ambassadors of the United States
to other parts of South America.
South America. We went to Bolivia. Went to Honduras and. And it was fun, and we had fun. Yeah, it's not very usual, I guess, but
fun in the Army.
Yeah,
Bill Falwell on bass, and Perry Robinson on clarinet, and Tom Price on drums. Who maybe we'll get Tom Price's angle and have the whole Uni Trio reunion.
He probably
at some
should.
Point.
Yeah,
yeah, he's got. I'm sure he's got stories to tell.
Definitely has stories.
This band, the group called the Uni Trio, and I should point out that we're catching up on some. The background from Bill Falwell's perspective of where he had been in music before, I guess we might as well use this as good a marker as any for when we can come up with some kind of music that the world may someday hear or has heard a representation of. And now, more and more, and I think this is part thanks to you and thanks to some initiative of this band, once it got out of the Army and became a professional unit, having been broadcast on New York radio, a lot of people suddenly said, well, that's what the Uni Trio was all about. But here's this group of a clarinetist who had made a record before going into the Army but was no superstar, and a drummer and bass player who had come from various backgrounds in the same way. They all fell together at the Navy School of Music in the Washington area and then all got a very good tip and were able to follow it through that they should ship out to be stationed in Panama. And I believe by, must be end of 63 or beginning of 64, you guys are in Panama
right.
For most of a couple of years and honing this music. Now, I've been listening to this music a little bit lately, and I hope the world has a lot of chances to listen to the examples, the early ones that we have of the Uni Trio. And I got to try and get this from Bill Falwell. Perry and I have tried, too. Where did that music come from? How did it hit you what the music that was being evolved by the Uni Trio was? Was that like anything you had heard before?
No, it wasn't. But we were just... God, this is a difficult question because... You know, where does music come from? You know, I mean, everybody's got their own little saying. Well, okay. But Perry had a way of playing, and we all had our, we all have our limitations and our you know, what's the word, you know, our strong points.
Yeah.
And then three people are locked together, and in a situation where I had to, well, you know, we just were there. We were listening to each other. We played and formed. Perry would have a little melody, and then we just put in what we, thought would go with it. Yep, there it goes.
What did you listen to? Because I know Perry mentioned that you guys had a copy of the Paul Blay record with Steve Swallow called Footloose.
Mm-hmm.
With
we had the Albert Eiler record, the with Gary Peacock and Sonny Murray. Is that right?
No, you didn't have that.
That wasn't out yet?
No, they were barely even together yet.
Okay, well then there you are.
I mean, that's what kills me. Is that
now, isn't that what Perry said too? He said we've listened to Albert down. Yeah, I knew Albert. No.
Well,
I listened to Lenny Bruce. I had a Lenny Bruce record.
Well, then maybe that's closer to the picture. There is one story that maybe we've skipped over, because I remember, I believe you've made a notation somewhere that you had, by the time you went to Panama, you had already heard what Albert Eiler's group sounded like, that maybe you got a moment while in Washington to run back upstate. Maybe you were, you know, checking in Rochester first and caught them in New York. This is the group with Sonny Murray and Gary. Am I telling you a fable?
I think so. I don't recall.
You don't remember seeing that group with Albert Eiler on tenor, Gary Peacock on bass, no, and Sonny Murray on
drums? I just remember the record. And I seem to remember sitting in the... Now, when did it come out? Tell me when it came out.
Well, that's a good question, and now you're calling me on the carpet. The reason I say I don't think it had happened yet is you're in Panama by, say, maybe the winter or spring of 1964, and that band didn't make their first appearance until April of 64.
Well, that could be then.
The record is made in July of 64, okay. And I wouldn't have thought it came out until much before 65, by which time you're pretty close to shipping.
We were just back, yeah.
See, and this is what gets me is, if there were a record like that, then maybe Tom Price would have some kind of model for, okay, this is what the avant-garde music of our time can be in a non-pulse world. Or maybe Bill Falwell will have a model, because it's not what Charlie Hayden was playing. You know, it's not what Steve Swallow was playing. All the records of the forefront of development in jazz were still experimental ways of playing tunes. You know, the way Scotty LaFaro mm-hmm. played, or the way Swallow played, or Peacock even in his earliest recordings. And what the Uni Trio has, seemingly without having studied up on whatever models there were, because there weren't any, is this way of playing in sort of a suspension of time, of the elapse of time, a suspension
Absolutely.
Of harmony and of pulse and meter, and yet it sounds totally natural and mature.
And we also were thinking of tunes rather than solos, per se. You know, everything was a little tune, a little 3-4 minute tune, and that's when we came out, we spent a lot of time on this Uni Trio. You know, and I at one point, you know, different stuff happened in the army. Like I got involved with the riot, and I lost my teeth, and then another time I was playing so hard I got a tendonitis or whatever, and came back from the doctor, and he had put a cast on me. You know, it's all stuff happened, but we, you know, carried on.
Yeah, you got you're reaching toward your left hand, saying you got lefty tendonitis.
Mm-hmm. No, from the, you know, you have to fold those strings down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that way of playing, we were just playing free, you know. And
so it was a new shock for your arm, I guess.
Well, I guess. I don't know. But they sorted it out, and I haven't had it since, so.
We'll be right back. Thank you.
That's music from the Uni Trio. Their band name is UNI, as in unification or unity or unit. There were three of them, and that's why it's the trio, even though there may be a sort of contradiction implied in the uni and the trio, but three voices moving as one on one of the scant few other recordings to document the Uni Trio. They had an opportunity to make a radio explanation of the fact that that's how they came up with the name, was that even though there were three different personalities, their idea was all about collaborative music making. You've just heard a segment of Uni Trio music that was recorded in 1964. In fact, we're going to hear a little bit more from it. And it figures into our program today at the midpoint in chronicling the life and times of the bassist in the band. His name is Bill Falwell, and he's the subject of our Jazz Profiles program, this five-hour extravaganza on Sunday afternoon, the 29th of June in 2007. Bill Falwell is not often the subject of Jazz Profiles. I think maybe in the world somewhere about 25 years ago there was a profile program about him, but perhaps nothing on this scale. And one of the added ingredients that's making this program special is not only Bill Falwell's narration of his own career, but also some of the resources, many of which are traceable to him and his preservation activities, that show us a world of music that isn't even recorded. In fact, almost nothing that you've heard in our chronological survey today has been made commercially available anyway, or in some cases there isn't a commercial record by these bands, like the Carla Bley Trio, or even Jimmy Heath's band at Upstate, or the group that you're listening to right now, the Uni Trio. Perry Robinson plays clarinet here. Tom Price is the drummer, and Bill Falwell is the bass player. You may have heard Bill Falwell make mention in his last discussion of how the Uni Trio came together, of the fact that Perry Robinson was the subject around the time this interview was taken in June, I believe, of 2002, of a biographical study that he spoke, and it was written into print form by Florence Wetzel, and that book is quite a cornerstone as far as the study of Perry Robinson goes, and the tangential matters such as the Bill Falwell's world, for that matter, or the Uni Trio's life and career, are given no better treatment anywhere than they are in that volume. And Falwell was recalling the time of the creation of that book, which is just around this point 5 years ago. It should be pointed out that one of the beautiful side effects of trying to unearth and piece together Perry Robinson's career, as was done at that time, was the fact that Tom Price came to light after many years of no one quite knowing what had happened to this musician, who made some significant records in 1965 and 66, and had this untold history with the Uni Trio. And the reason that Bill Falwell was in town 5 years ago from his home in Florida was the fact that he was coming to play the first reunion gig that the Uni Trio had ever made in just about 35 years at that point. The band after Falwell carried on, and I believe for a moment had David Eisenson playing bass, and then maybe Randy Kay or someone else came in on drums. There were different stages of the Uni Trio, but the original membership coming together to make music for the first time in forever was a cause for celebration. They did so at, I believe, Macor on the Upper West in Manhattan in June of 2002, and in fact it was on the very night after this career retrospective interview took place. So now we're reflecting on the reflection on the reflection of what the Uni Trio was, and there's a lot more reflecting to do, including some more music now, a little bit more discussion from Bill Falwell about how that figures into his future, and hopefully even farther down the road, separate from our program today about Falwell, another chance to dig into in full breadth and depth the music of the Uni Trio. The first piece you heard just now, the waltz with the march underpinning by Tom Price, was called Eggs and Rice, if I'm not mistaken. And as Perry Robinson described it, that was one of the works that, well, I guess it's a piece named after a phrase that names something that was in the consciousness of the Uni Trio membership as they were on the South American tour with the band from their military installation on the banks of the Panama Canal in 1964 and 65. So Eggs and Rice in the mind of Perry Robinson, and that turned into one of the theme and variations presentations that you've heard on this series of excerpts of the Uni Trio. The other two pieces I couldn't tell you names for, but I believe that their names can be known, and the name of this next piece is Peace. It's a rather well-known piece. It's not P-I-E, but P-E-A-C-E, written by Ornette Coleman. And it's, though it's not really said in the discussion in 2002, it can be fairly said that if there is a basis for this music, apart from the inspiration of Albert Eiler and the music that he had brought forward to that time, it would be the fundament of Ornette Coleman's music, and perhaps even counter to what Ben Young was saying in this interview from 5 years ago. There is something to be felt of the flavor of Charlie Hayden and even Hayden and Higgins as relates to Ornette Coleman's rendering of Lonely Woman from the same album that gave us Peace. So, resting on the background of Ornette Coleman and the fundamental work of what would be called free jazz and the pioneering work of Albert Eiler as one of the breakthrough artists to show a new dimension for the music comes this group, the Uni Trio, whose significance ought not to be left aside. So part of rectifying that is put into our program today. Again, it's Jazz Profiles with the topic Bill Falwell, the guest Bill Falwell, and our program runs until 7 p.m. That's 2 hours and 20 remaining on this Sunday afternoon, June 29th. My name is Ben Young, and I'll be with you for the duration, and we dive back into Peace from the Uni Trio from a recording that I understand was made, it must be the first of the three known recordings of the Uni Trio, made in Panama on what should be November the 8th of 1964. Thank you.
We're talking here with Bill Falwell on a lot of topics coming up on the end of a long and prosperous, fruitful time, I guess I should say, in Panama in 1964 and 65 with this Uni Trio. Did you feel like this was a new direction for you in music and one that was going to change the way that you thought about things?
Absolutely. I mean, when we all said, I mean, that's what we said, when we're getting out of the Army, we're going to come to New York and get it together and do it.
Right.
That's what we're going to do. We're going to do it. So I took that as, you know, that's what we're going to do.
That was the direction.
Direction,
and the goal.
Absolutely.
Back to New York then, as soon as you get discharged?
Mm-hmm. Well, I went home and straightened stuff out, and then I moved to New York.
Right.
It took a little while, and by the time I got, I can't remember. You know, Perry was living at home, and Tom,
Perry's place was, this is when he's living on Willoughby Walk, is that what?
Willoughby Street,
area
I think.
Yeah.
With his dad.
In Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn Heights, yeah.
And then the Uni Trio, you and Tom moved in close by, I guess.
God, it seems like we moved right in. And then we got a place, or they got a place, and there's some, you know, there's some fady kind of memory back. You know, that's a long time ago.
Yeah.
But I know one thing we did. I had my little tape recorder, and we would... Perry's house was, I was there, and we'd invite different players to come over who we liked. Paul Blay and Don Friedman came over, I think, and jam with the Uni Trio.
Yeah, yeah. With positive results?
We felt they were positive.
Were you always playing Uni Trio tunes, or in those cases, would you abridge that all together and just say, let's just play? Or would you play Paul Blay tune, or whatever Paul Blay was playing?
I think it was... A little of both, probably. It was always give and take. Paul was certainly flexible.
Yeah. Did you ever think of adding somebody else on? I mean, I ask that in part because listening to the one recording that I know about of the Uni Trio in that period, on some of the heads, you, maybe from a trumpet player's sensibility and from, you know, sort of the playing and composing simultaneously sensibility, there's a line where Perry will be playing the melody to the tune, and you and Tom will join in, and then at some point you'll sing a note because there's a need for another voice, another melody voice.
Well, that's what I felt, and I, hell yeah, go for that.
Would you have considered pulling somebody else into the band, Uni Trio plus one, or Uni Quartet?
I wasn't in my thinking. No.
Right.
And I don't, you know, Perry, he's a difficult person that, you know, I mean, he's got his own way, and it's hard to tell what it is sometimes. There were times when we separated too, and I was doing other. You know, he said, "Oh, go take that gig," you know, and then he was trying to do something else with somebody else. You know, who knows? And I'm very sensitive myself. You know,
right? Were there any of these side gigs that were memorable in that time as sort of a freelance
for
thing
me?
On the side? Yeah.
Well, I guess I went to Toronto with, I can't remember.
With Sonny Murray?
No, it was with an alto player.
Marion Brown?
Yeah.
Okay.
I went with Marion Brown, and there was a singer there, too, girl singer.
Oh, who would that have been? Jean Lee? No, way too early for that.
No, I just...
Patty Waters?
Maybe.
You know Patty Waters.
Well, as I say, it was just a single gig, and it was fraught with problems. I was going to a rehearsal for it, and I had an accident, and I whacked my cheek, and I was, I think, spitting up dried blood all the time I was in Toronto, and I was kind of nervous about that, you know. So I
right. Who else made that? Remember who else made that trip? Who was the drummer?
It must have been Beaver, maybe.
Okay.
Huh. Is he still around?
No, Beaver Harris died 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago, I think. So you got it, man. We got to get the stories from
Bill
Falwell.
And it's no good because my mind is mush, you know.
No, not true. The man who claims his mind is mush on the opposite channel is Bill Falwell. And my name is Ben Young. We're here at WKCR speaking on the topic of Bill Falwell, of all things.
Why would anybody do that?
Well, because it's a great story, and a great musician who is making a reappearance in some familiar territory here, and WKCR would love to capitalize on that. Now, we're running across a... we've mentioned the name of Albert Eiler a couple of times, mainly because anybody who's catching up to this interview is most likely to recognize your name in the context of, oh, yeah, that guy. Albert Eiler.
Where did he
player.
Come from?
Well, and now they've caught up on the where did he come from, and we're going to continue spinning through this up to the to where did he go sort of trajectory. But let's catch up for a minute here about the way the seeds are planted with your working with Albert Eiler. Am I right to think that he might have been one of the people you invited over, that the Uni Trio had over as sort of a special guest at one of these things?
I don't recall Albert ever being there. I just... And we got to sort out where we heard that record, though. That
well, I can bet that by the time you came back to New York, you
oh yeah, heard definitely it, heard it,
and you might even have had a chance to hear Albert in person. Do you think you heard him on records before you heard him in person?
Yes, I think so.
What did you think? Hearing
it was
the
great. I mean, that was a great record, and I really loved it.
Spiritual Unity.
Spiritual Unity. Absolutely. It was. I mean, it was just everything. It was right about it.
Yep.
Everything was right. And it was a masterpiece.
Yeah,
everybody was just doing the right thing, and it was great.
Would you remember when you first met Albert Eiler?
I think I met him at Village Gate, maybe, and I think I can't remember
when he was playing a gig there, or when you were.
I don't know. He was talking about he needed a bass player to go to Europe with him for the Newport Festival Goes to Europe. And what year was that?
Fall of 66.
66.
Yeah.
And we'd been back and we'd done our Uni Trio stuff and we'd beat our heads against whatever walls we could find. And,
right.
You know, we did everything we could. And
is that how Albert would have known who you were?
Perhaps.
Maybe he
perhaps,
was.
Maybe Perry mentioned me to you. If Perry's book says he mentioned... I'm the reason that I got the gig with Albert, of course. So.
Right, right.
Well, I enjoyed that. Thanks. I enjoyed that. But anyway, so we says, come over, you know, play. And I think he asked somebody, how does he play? And they said, yeah, he plays pretty good. I have no idea what went on. But I rehearsed with Albert and met the guys. And I think we rehearsed on the Village Gate. First rehearsal or whatever, trying to put in. And he says, "These are the tunes we're playing." And I said, "Well, what do I do?" You know, well, I didn't really ask that. I just did what I thought needed,
right.
And I played the bow. Which subsequently, at that period when I came back, I studied with a bass player with the New York Phil
Zimmerman.
Yeah, I studied with him,
uh-huh.
And he was a master. And yeah. Studying with him was just, I mean, that was like a holiday. You know, you go up to his house, and he had beautiful paintings on the walls, you know, just original. It was super.
You had that in common with Alan Silva, who also took some lessons from Zimmerman. Maybe not as regularly.
Well.
But that was how you were sharpening skills on the bow,
was
studying with somebody from the
studying with him, and so I, and the bow seemed to work. Albert was happy with it, and we wrapped us all together and got on the plane, I guess. It was pretty quick.
Right. Did it seem to you when you were doing these rehearsals at the gate that the rest of the band knew the tunes and it was up to you to figure them out, or that everybody was sort of coagulating for the
first time? Well, I think Albert and Donald... They were their tunes. I mean, it was Albert, and it's just my conjecture that they were so simple, so that Don, I mean, it was just something that they could play together. That's my thought on. And they had
Michelle. Right.
And
now here's the tough one. We're going back to the Village Gate. You're rehearsing with Albert Eiler for a couple of afternoons before going on the road to Europe,
right?
For Newport or for the Newport
Festival
tour.
Goes to Europe.
There you go. Was there paper music there?
No, there was no paper music. You mean written?
Yep.
No.
Okay.
No. There was no music.
What did you, as a trumpet player, what did you think of Donald Eiler?
He's basic. You know, when I listen to him now, he played loud as well. And he had a strong lip, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, he really played live. He was not particularly
you didn't think he was emotional. A virtuoso?
No.
But he could say what he wanted to say.
I guess he did.
Or maybe he did say what he could say.
Yeah, that's exactly. That's a better way to put it, I think. Huh. And there were, you know, the tunes. You know what the tunes sound like. And
I do.
And it was basically, you know, 1-4-5, you know, chord structure, whatever. And then it would just go off and just make as much energy as you can, Bill, or even, you know, I mean, that's what it was.
Right.
That's what I did, anyway.
Well, do you remember any instructions or any kind of thing that, like, would Albert turn to you and say, you know, maybe not, or maybe this, and
no,
something like that?
Never say anything. So it's not his fault that I know. I don't know.
The way you play with the bow is, it's interesting that you bring that up, because that wasn't the most common thing and might not have been the natural reaction of a lot of bass players to how to deal with that music, to, in other words, to create another sustaining voice rather than just the pizzicato voice from the bass. And yet, did you think that, well, I'll play the bow for the heads maybe, and, you know, to support the statement, and then when this the period, great energetic period comes up in the music, is that the time to switch over to pizzicato and become a rhythm?
I think Albert might have said, liked the having the bow going through the whole thing. You know, I think he liked what I was doing, so I obviously, to please my leader, you know.
Yeah.
I would do what I felt was right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we're at that point where it's all feelings, really. You know, I mean, it's uncharted territory, so to speak.
Yeah. Did you, this may seem like a strange question, because obviously you believe in that music, and, you know, that this is a music that the world has come to believe in, and you were, you know, fantastic as a role player within Albert Eiler's group, and even within the Uni Trio, for that matter. But did you find a clash?
Really?
Did you see that there was, like, an opposition of principles between 5 years spent in music schools and then coming out, and this is the situation that I'm in, that clearly this is music. It's not what they teach you in school.
I wanted to be a jazz musician, and I mean, I didn't look back, so to speak. You know?
Was that jazz music, though? It wasn't Pee Wee Ellis.
No, it was jazz music, though.
All right.
I mean, it was jazz music. I mean, it was whatever they called it, the avant-garde jazz music. And it was Albert Eiler, and I was so impressed with that record, you know, and impressed with the fact that we were traveling to Europe with the Newport Jazz Festival goes to Europe. All the idols I ever had in my life were on that tour. You know, yeah. I mean, it was just phenomenal.
Now, the way the tour was organized, you made, what, half a dozen or a dozen stops, I guess, all across Europe.
Yeah.
In an unfortunately collapsed kind of period of time where you had to play a different city every
night.
Yeah,
it was 13 days, or 15 days, 13 concerts, something right. like that.
Was it everybody playing on the bill every night, or was it a couple of nights?
They split the concert. They had the white and the black half.
Really?
You know, it was one bunch went one way,
right,
and the other bunch went the other way. Brubeck and Stan Getz and whatever went one way, and
oh, I see. They switched midway so that everybody would have 2 weeks of or Brubeck 1 week, and then Max Roach and Albert Eiler the next week, or something like that.
No, it was all at once, but they had one tour going at certain countries. We, like, what did we do? We did Germany, and you probably know it better than I do.
You're in Holland, Germany,
yeah,
Amsterdam, Denmark. Must have been in France, definitely in France. Switzerland.
France, and we didn't do Switzerland. We did...
Where is Lerach? Is that not in Switzerland? That's in Germany, I'm sorry. Lerach in Germany.
Okay. We might have gone to Switzerland. I remember, well, you know, now it's coming back. No, where the hell were we? You know, it was tough, you know, because it was a night and, you know, you go in a hotel. Yeah. I had my one white shirt that was wash and wear, and I wore my suit, and this is what I need to have.
Right.
And so... And I had an accident on that tour, too. How long are we going here?
Oh.
You're not worried about that, right?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I just,
my God, oh, my God. So we went to I had an accident getting off the bus. We did the first concert, and the reception was, you know, here we are in the middle with all these pretty mainline players, Max Roach and that bunch, Freddie Hubby.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they call him, Freddie Hubby. Hey, Freddie Hubby. And Max Roach and Roy Eldridge, I think, was on the thing. And
Papa Joe Jones and, Illinois Jacquet, I guess, was in the band.
Yeah. And then they had the four tap dancers with us, Jimmy Slide and those people. And so it was pretty good cross-section of music. And
yeah.
They used to laugh. They get in the back of the bus, boy. You know, because we were driving bus around to the gigs and stuff. Yeah.
Oh, you're saying that all of these musicians were on one bus together?
Yeah. We flew together, went to the hotels together, and so that was the tour.
Right.
And the tour was arranged, and we had somebody looking after us from England, you know, to make sure we stayed in line, you know. And so we jumped, and then I asked you if anybody ever saw the video we made. We made some sort of video at a German...
television station?
No, it was actually a movie studio.
Hmm.
And it wasn't a video. Well, maybe it was a video, but anyway, we stood in front of the camera and played, and they took pictures of us, but not with an audience or anything. It was just separate.
Did it strike you that was made for television, that it was going to be, you know, broadcast later or something like that?
I really don't know what the purpose of it. And I know that Albert's wanted to stay there or do something. You know, he wanted to stay. He signed on to do the trip, but he wanted to do other stuff there.
Stay in Europe and do other stuff.
Yeah, I think that was his intent.
Did you know that before you signed on with him for that trip?
No.
But little by little, he said, what if
trying to get something going here, right, or whatever. And,
he didn't really.
It looked like it was pretty much everything was controlled by
whoever the organizer was.
Yeah. And
George Wein, you mean?
George Wein, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was pretty much tied up. And I don't know the relations with George Wein and Albert Eiler and why he said, well, let's bring Eiler to Europe. And, you know, all that stuff that's pretty far out because we definitely was a different kind of group to have with this bunch of people.
The only intelligence I have on that score that may shed some light on it is that the Newport Festival obviously happens in Rhode Island every year, but it had an international following, and it was a brand name that people could work by that time, so taking a package tour like that overseas was a very lucrative
instant
thing.
Instant sell.
Yeah, exactly. And it had the name on it already. So in doing that, there was sort of a partnership set up between a man who you might say was like the George Wein or the Willis Conover of Germany, this man named Joachim Ernst Behrendt, who ran...
Okay.
He was a radio personality, television personality, a concert producer and promoter, host, and eventually an archivist and record producer as well. And I'm wondering if maybe he was the guy behind that television thing, because it's well known that he arranged for certain musicians who he had brought overseas, you know, from the United States to tour there to be in on some sort of film.
You know, it was like the second day or third day of the tour,
right,
that this thing happened.
I think that he had something to do with putting Albert on that tour, because Wein had a cooperative venture where he said, okay, well, we'll send you the guys that we want to send, you know, the top billed people from the States, the Max Roach group, this Willie the Lion Smith group, and, you know, the Illinois Jacquet group. Who do you want? Who does Europe want? Who is Europe starving for? And Behrendt's answer, either speaking for a Europe that was much hipper than the States and wanting to hear Albert Eiler in concert rather than on a sawdust floor with 15 people in the audience, or because it was just, he said, this is the music of our time and we need to promote it. He said, okay, we'll take all of your guys, but let's have Albert Eiler too.
Okay, so it was a...
I think that's how he got on the path.
Hostage demand.
Well, maybe. Thank goodness for it, no matter what the circumstance.